Well, g'day and welcome to another edition of the National Conservative Institute of Australia podcast. My guest today is the Black Horse, the anonymous X handle for one of the most interesting and perceptive commentators on Canadian politics and culture to have emerged in recent years. In this episode, we do a deep dive on Canada and discuss the underlying competition in that country between various power blocs, the importance of trade and immigration policies in creating and maintaining Canadian nationhood, and how this has been forgotten in recent years with detrimental consequences, many of the parallels between the Canadian political situation and that in Australia, who is going to win the upcoming Canadian election and why, and much more. I hope you enjoy our discussion. Well, the Black Horse, welcome to the NatCon Australia podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
No sweat. I've been following your work for some time, and I find you, as others have, one of the more interesting, perceptive commentators on current day Canadian politics and culture. For those that are unfamiliar with you, how did you come to start writing about this subject, and what's your general background?
Yeah, okay. I got interested in political theory from kind of an interesting perspective. I come from the investment industry, and as early as maybe 2013, 2014, I started to realize that standard explanations of politics were insufficient for particularly understanding how U.S. politics worked. So I became very interested in the period between about 2014, 2013, and maybe 2018 in trying to develop a better model for particularly how U.S. politics functioned, mostly in service to my day job. And in doing so, I explored a really, really wide variety of political theory. I read, you know, everything from Yarvin to Vilfredo Pareto to Mosca, I also read on the left, but I kind of built a model for politics that came out of the Italian elite theorists, Pareto, Mosca, Machiavelli, that group of thinkers. And after observing U.S. politics through this lens for a while, I started to realize that a lot of what I knew about Canadian politics actually maps really elegantly onto it. And so I started working at Canadian politics is much smaller than American politics. So you can actually do a very complete job mapping the ecosystem of power here and get a really nice map of how Canadian politics works. And so I did that with a bunch of people that I'd met in the space. And I started writing about it on a Substack that I created called The Red Ensign. The Red Ensign has kind of three components. The first is this kind of cold-blooded analysis of power in Canadian politics, which is the kind of the meat and potatoes of it. And then there's a certain amount of discussion of Canadian culture and just thoughtful writing about how to make a way forward for the Canadian people in light of this kind of analysis of our politics.
Yeah, it's interesting because, and this will be an oversimplification, but reading your commentary, it's your analysis of Canadian politics is less about the ideological division per se, or at least in the way we understand it between, say, the Conservative Party and the Liberal Party, but more in terms of power blocks, the Laurentian elite and then the Western state bloc, if I've got those terms correct. Is that right?
Yeah. So most of Canadian politics has an ideological veneer on top of it, but is not right. But the driving forces behind Canadian politics are primarily not ideological. So Canada went through a process of elite fracture in the 70s, where what was then a fairly consolidated ruling elite was partly displaced in Quebec by a Quebecois nationalist elite, and partly displaced in the West by a fractured portion of the Laurentian elite, who have now become a recognizable elite class in their own right that I've dubbed the Western elite.
And what are the Laurentian elite, for those who aren't familiar with it, and what are the Western elite in broad terms?
So the Laurentian elite are the historical ruling class of Canada going back to the end of the imperial period. They built their power out of local government in Canada during the imperial period and industrial development in Canada during that period. They dominated Canadian politics through the 20th century. Their political their primary political vehicle, the Liberal Party, was in power in Canada more years in the 20th century than the Communist Party was in Russia. Today, they represent a group of people who are primarily located in the corridor between Toronto and Montreal, and who occupy positions in media, academia, and government, primarily with a smattering in Canadian business. The Western elite were... So if you go back to the 70s, there was a failed attempt in Canada to transform Canada into kind of a Venezuela-style state capitalist venture, with an effort to nationalize the oil industry under what was then called the National Energy Policy. That effort failed. Because that effort failed, there was a particularly aggrieved set of very rich and very powerful people in the oil and in the energy industry in Alberta, but also in related resource extraction industries in Alberta. That gradually formed into a politically active elite class that are generally called the Western elite. Through the 90s and early 2000s, they captured the Conservative Party of Canada, which previously was another vehicle for the Laurentian elite, and now really represents a distinct set of economic interests in the country.
Yeah, and aren't there ideological divisions though? Isn't the Western Bloc, you know, much more free market capitalism, Reagan-esque, and the liberal elite is much more blue state, you know, New England liberal, you know, left wing kind of attitudes? Isn't that
has been more and less true at different times in Canadian history?
Yeah.
So if you go back to the 1955 election, there's a very famous article in the Globe and Mail where it characterized the three parties as the Conservatives support the welfare state from the cradle to the grave, the Liberals support the welfare state from the womb to the tomb, and the NDP support the welfare state from conception to resurrection. So almost throughout Canadian history, the ideological divisions between the parties have been much less than they have been in many other countries. For a period of time in the 80s, there's a division in Canada between the Conservative Party and the Liberal Party, which seems very ideological, and it is centered around the issue of free trade with the United States. The Conservative Party under then Prime Minister Brian Mulroney leads Canada into NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, but before that leads it into the Auto Pact and into a series of reciprocal reductions in tariffs. Now, this seems like a very ideological kind of free market capitalism thing, and in some senses, I guess it is, but it's also a profound attack on the interests of the Laurentian elite, who had built their fortunes on in Canadian industry, predicated on this kind of network of high tariffs and protectionist measures that protected their economic interests from larger organizations in the United States. And so you can see, even as early as the 80s, where the Conservative Party is still in struggling in sort of civil war over control, a lot of these divisions, which appear to be ideological, also represent the difference in interest between the pieces in the Canadian elite who are focused on the export economy and the pieces in the Canadian elite who benefit from the local manufacturing economy.
Yeah. I mean, how to put this? The center-right parties across the Anglosphere changed their tune on free trade in the 70s and 80s. So they, people now associate, you know, the Republican Party and the, I guess, the Conservatives in Canada and the Liberal Party here in Australia with being the party, the center-right being free traders. But that was not always the case. And in Canada, it's particularly interesting because, at least in my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, but from the days of like John A. Macdonald,
yeah,
there's been recognition that trade policy is fundamental to Canada's ongoing existence, and also the nature of the country that it becomes. Is that fair?
Yeah, the Conservative Party for 100 years was the champion of a set of tariff policies called the National Policy, which were designed to retain the economic sovereignty of Canada under the presupposition that was a requirement to maintaining the political sovereignty of Canada. The assumption being that if the axis of trade in Canada reoriented itself north-south rather than east-west, inevitably parts or all of Canada would be annexed to the United States. Right, that was the theory behind the National Policy, and for many years, the Conservative Party was the champion of this set of policies. That all changed in the 70s and 80s when the Conservative Party and the voters that it represented became more and more attached to the resource extraction industries and the export economy, which was associated with them. And so you can see their ideological commitment to Canada as a project came second to the economic interests of the people who kind of led the party. And so all of these people who had been, economic nationalists for 100 years suddenly woke up and discovered that because there was oil in Alberta, they were free traders.
Yeah.
And this is the story of if you try to explain Canadian politics on the basis of ideology and look for consistent ideological threads through its history, you run up against moments like the 80s, moments like what's going on right at the moment, and you can't explain it. Whereas if you look at the interests of the people who actually control the parties rather than their nominal ideological affiliation, you get a much more coherent story.
Yeah, there is a similar story in Australia where that Western Australia, which is the big resources state, did pump a lot of money into some of the, political parties and the think tanks in the 70s. And the Liberal Party of Australia's position on trade fundamentally changed. And then it's now pretended as though that was always the case and that anything prior to the 80s was, an intellectual error that we can tolerate, but was somehow never really truly believed by anyone like, Australia's longest-serving Prime Minister, Robert Menzies.
Of course, if you actually read what they wrote, they knew exactly that they were paying a cost for nationalism.
Exactly, yeah. And in Canada's case, I mean, John A. Macdonald, it was very much tied to maintaining the British character and traditions and not being subsumed by the United States. And I think he literally says not having trade policy dictated by Washington.
Well, it's interesting because John A. Macdonald at the time is on one half of a completely different elite struggle in Canada, because at the time, the struggle is between John A. Macdonald, who is a kind of Canadian nationalist, and the imperial elite, who at the time think that Canada as a country is kind of a fiction and kind of ridiculous, and that all lines of power ought to end in London. And so you see the struggle is actually the national policy is the consensus element of it, and then the struggle is over what trade policy versus London is going to be rather than what trade policy versus Washington is going to be.
Yeah, no, there are parallels in Australia at Federation where you had that similar pull and tug between those who wanted to essentially maintain the 19th century free trade liberalism and then those who had a much more nationalist bent that recognized trade and immigration and other policies needed to change because Australia was a new nation and the rest of it. I can see it, although I'm by no means an expert. I can see that in Canada during that time as well. We've talked a lot about the history, and I find it really interesting stuff, but you guys do have an upcoming election. Who's going to win that and why?
It is going to be very tight. So we'll kind of review the narrative and then we can come back to some of the reasons. So Canada has been ruled now for a decade by the Liberal Party under the leadership of Justin Trudeau. That leadership has been a disaster for the nation. We've gone through a 10-year period during which we've had the worst economic growth of anyone in the G20, with the exception of Luxembourg. We've had, I think it's like 2% compounded over the, or 2% total over the 10-year period. It's horrendous. We've had tremendous abuse of the population through the kind of cultural policies and the very extreme migration policies that have prevailed over the period, as well as the fiasco that was COVID in Canada. And so you got to a position where Justin Trudeau was personally exceptionally unpopular to the point where he couldn't appear in public anywhere that was announced in advance without, very heavy police presence. He couldn't run a campaign. He couldn't run a photo op because he'd just get heckled everywhere. And so over the Christmas recess, other members of the Liberal Party organized a kind of party coup to remove him as leader. He was replaced after his resignation by Mark Carney, the former governor of the Bank of Canada, then governor of the Bank of England, who then called an election. And sitting in behind this has been quite a dramatic set of negotiations with the United States over the tariff relationship. As you might imagine, the United States is Canada's largest single trading partner, and maybe doesn't do it justice. A very large fraction of Canada's economy is fundamentally dependent on trade with the United States. Something like 90% of all Canadian trade passes through the United States. So it's a very, very important issue here. And the kind of blustery and threatening negotiation style of President Trump, particularly his comments where he kind of explicitly threatened to annex Canada as a state, really stirred up domestic politics here. So when Mark Carney took over the leader, well, when Justin Trudeau resigned, the Conservative Party was leading in the polls by historic margins. The expectation was that you're going to have a massive CPC majority. Between the difficult trade negotiations, the replacement of Trudeau with Mark Carney, we then inverted that situation where shortly after Mark Carney had been selected as leader, with Trump making his annexation comments, we looked like we were going to have a solid Liberal majority. We're now, from a polling point of view, in a position where it looks like it will be a minority government one way or another. What's happened is that the kind of nationalistic furor that kind of broke out has kind of dissolved, and we look a lot more like our traditional regional voting patterns, where the west of the country looks like it is going to vote for the Conservative Party, their typical political representatives, and the population corridor along the St. Lawrence Basin is going to vote overwhelmingly for the Liberal Party, and you're going to get sort of a 40-40 split in terms of seats between the two of them. And then you're going to have enough between the Bloc Québécois, which are the French Canadian Nationalist Party, and the Socialist Party and the Green Party, some collection of seats that will make up the balance of power. And there will be a very delicate game to try to form and maintain a minority government in a difficult parliament. At least that's the way the polls look at the moment. With election day just a couple days away.
Yeah. I mean, it does seem such an incredible turnaround, because the polls at one stage had the Conservative Party of Canada up 30 points or something, and that's all essentially collapsed. It's weird to me that the public have been able to disassociate Justin Trudeau's popularity from the party that he was governing at all that time. So what happened to the discontent regarding poor economic performance and mass immigration and other things?
Well, so there, what you're looking at here is a classic kind of rally around the flag effect. So the Liberal Party of Canada are the traditional keepers of Canadian nationalism. And the comments from the President of the United States really stirred up Canadian nationalism in a way that has not occurred in 30, 40 years. And so a lot of people who were otherwise politically inactive became active as potential voters for the Liberal Party of Canada as a form of resistance against the United States. Because the Conservative Party have been associated with this kind of free trade with the United States has been like a big flag, a big standard for the Conservative Party of Canada. They've stood for an agenda of deep integration with the United States, which has all been predicated on the unspoken promise that the United States is not a threat to Canada's sovereignty. And to have the President of the United States come out and explicitly threaten Canada's sovereignty in that way really undermined the credibility of that sort of generation-long message from the Conservative Party of Canada, and really damaged their reputation among particularly older white Canadians who would otherwise be a very solid bloc for the Conservative Party.
Yeah, it just seems a complete turnaround from Justin Trudeau, and I think his quote was, you know, Canada's going to be a post-national state, to now seeing the Liberal Party being the embodiment of new Canadian nationalism, right?
Well, so the Liberal Party has always been the keeper of Canadian nationalism. Remember, the Liberal Party was in power for almost the entire 20th century. Every Canadian prime minister that you learn about in history class besides John A. Macdonald was a Liberal. And a lot of Canada's sort of, particularly for older Canadians, a lot of the sort of national identity of Canada is wrapped up in the kind of in Liberal sensibilities. I mean, the Liberal Party is responsible for our flag, is responsible for our national anthem. They made our flag in the color of their party to look like their party lawn signs. It's kind of a branding exercise as much as anything. And it's a branding exercise that has been very, very effective. They also dominate the media. This is something most people outside the country probably don't know. Canada has official state media in the CBC, but it also has a program where all of the major publications in Canada are federally subsidized, and they're federally subsidized with content controls that go with that federal subsidy. So every journalist in the country gets something like 30% of their salary from the federal government via subsidy. So we have a very, very controlled media environment, which has been curated by the Liberal Party for a certain vision of nationalism for a very, very long time. That vision of nationalism sees like the comments that Trudeau made about post-nationalism and about the end of the Anglo-French identity, weirdly enough, kind of fit into that version of a story about Canada, about Canada's self. It's a story that I find particularly objectionable, but it's a story that has a lot of currency, particularly with older Canadians who have not had to live very long with the challenges that have come out of the attempt to execute it.
Yeah, right. I mean, scrolling through Twitter in preparation for this, I saw a comment by a Canadian, I think it's a Quebecois politician, Yves-François Blanchet,
yeah,
calls Canada an artificial country with very little meaning. He doesn't feel at ease in the Canadian Parliament, he says. I mean, is it possible to sort of define what are the Canadian people and what the justification really is for them remaining a separate nation rather than an interesting province of the United States of America?
Yeah, Canada is a union between three nations, or was a union between three nations, that is a political arrangement of convenience in order to protect it from homogenization in the United States with the United States. Those three peoples are the French Canadian people, Anglo Canadian people, and the Native Canadian people, all of whom didn't have an enormous amount in common, but all of whom liked each other a whole lot better than they liked the United States, all of whom saw the United States as a fundamental threat to their identity and as a very aggressive threat to their identity. So going back, I mean, the Anglo-Canadian people find their origin as loyalists, those who sided with the crown in the American Revolution and were resettled as refugees. You can understand their imperialist sentiments and their kind of anti-Americanism. The Franco-Canada, the Quebec Act, which protected Franco, what is now French Canada, was named in the Declaration of Independence as one of the chief grievances against the crown. So you can kind of understand that the effort to protect Franco-Canada has been a sore point with the United States for a very long time. This is well understood in Quebec. It's also well understood that the French that lived in Louisiana or lived in what became New England have long ago lost their identity in a way that the French Canadians in Quebec have not. And Native Canadians have always had a kind of, well, through most of Canadian history, have had a pretty productive relationship with first the British Crown and then the Canadian government, which has always stood in pretty stark contrast to the more adversarial relationship between Native peoples and the United States government. Remember that one of the reasons the Quebec Act was very upsetting to the American colonists was that it protected tribal lands from settlement. And the American state did not do a very good job of that in the aftermath of the American Revolution. So that those are the three peoples. Those are their grievances against the Americans historically. This broad sentiment that Canada protects those groups of people from assimilation into American culture has been kind of the justification for Canada as a political unit through most of its history. And so you can see how that justification can be activated by certain dynamics in the relationship with the United States pretty profoundly. Now, in the era of Canada went through a process after the British Empire dissolved, which is called by historians the invention of Canada, during which Canada got a new flag, a new national anthem, was reconceptualized by Trudeau the Elder as a cultural mosaic rather than a union of two peoples. And that kind of neoliberal gloss from the 70s has formed a very important part of the Canadian education and sort of propaganda system for the last 50 or 60 years. And so that also forms a core part of the justifying narrative for Canada as the kind of shining star of liberalism that the United States has never been able to be.
I must say, when I've visited Canada, there's still I feel like, for example, on Bay Street in Toronto, there's far more Union Jacks down that street than you would find on even the most,
yes, it's much more
element of Sydney or Melbourne, for example.
Much more British than Australia.
And it's as though they're sort of defining themselves against the, I mean, I can understand the older Canada, they respect the United States. It's bigger. It obviously meets, it's economically dynamic, but their kind of attitude, at least from a distance, it seems as though, look, we are better run. Our system is better. Our system of laws, we're less corrupt. And it makes sense in those terms for us to maintain ourselves as a separate people, along with the other things that you described. But in the 70s, because of the collapse, essentially, the British Empire and the prestige attached to it, that all had to change. I mean, how do you explain that change in your kind of power analysis?
So in the period between 1860 and 1960, Canada runs on this tension between the imperial elites that face London and the Laurentian elites who are Canadian nationalists. In the period after the Second World War, the power available for the imperial elites dries up to an extreme degree. There's a kind of last-ditch effort under John Diefenbaker to kind of unite imperialism and populism to fight the reinvention of Canada. But you get Canada handed over to the Laurentian elite as almost the only elite class operating in the country in that period. Now, Pierre Trudeau, who comes onto the stage politically very shortly thereafter, takes this enormously powerful position and immediately ruins it by his abuse of the country. We talked about the national energy policy on the one hand, but also he takes discontent in Quebec over cultural issues and just pours gas on the fire. There's an incident called the October Crisis, where after an escalating series of issues, two members of the Canadian government are held hostage by the FLQ, French Canadian terrorists. Pierre Trudeau invokes the War Measures Act and tries to put soldiers on every street corner through the entire province, succeeds in doing so, and martial law stays in place for more than a month, and mass arrests follow. The fact that at the end of that process, that effort is very unpopular both in Quebec and in English Canada and results in a long period of, it results in a very motivated, very consolidated French Canadian elite class that they foster separatism for a long period of time, but they also use all kinds of other tools to reinforce Quebec identity inside of Quebec. They use economic nationalism. They use language laws to force Anglo-Canadians out of the province. And so you get this situation where Canada had a very consolidated elite, and you have a fracture at west and a fracture in the east, and suddenly you get into this very kind of regional push and pull politics that have dominated Canada since then. And it made Canada from a very easy place to govern into a very difficult place to govern for the there are efforts after Trudeau to try to pull this all back together again, but it's never very successful.
I mean, do you think the center will hold going forward? I mean,
I don't think there's any chance whatsoever. You have you have these three elite classes that have completely divergent interests, that there's no level of trust, and all they share in common is that if the country ceases to exist, their political arrangements that keep them in their positions of wealth and power will cease to exist. And so all three of them are committed to the political status quo in Canada only from a kind of cynical point of view. And all three of them are just, the application of a threat of annexation is really the only thing that could have tried to put them back together. But it's only been 6 weeks and we're already back to Alberta separatism and Quebec separatism. If these parties are ever going to go back together and you're going to have a united vision for the country, it's going to be a long time.
Yeah. And you think that's the case, regardless of who wins the election? And And in what time frame? I mean, I'm trying to work out. Are you genuinely thinking there could be a breakup between those three different geographical regions at some level?
Yeah, I think what you're going to see is de facto separatism, like you've seen. So, over the last 10 years, there's been a great deal of de facto separatism. So, in Alberta, you had something called the Alberta Sovereignty Act, which is a provincial law brought in with the expressed intent of nullifying federal law. Similar situation with the Saskatchewan First Act, Saskatchewan borders Alberta, similar idea. They want to be able to nullify particularly federal environmental law that they see as an attack on their economic interests. In Quebec, there's already a prospect that there will be another referendum. Because of the situation in Quebec historically, there's an established framework for how separatism how a referendum would lead to a breakup of the country. Both fragments of the country have figured out that they can leverage threats to break the country apart to extract concessions from the central government. And I think you're going to continue to see this pattern where the provinces succeed in leveraging concessions from the federal government to make the federal and weakening the federal government as an effective force, further reinforcing this kind of division in the Canadian elite.
Yeah. I mean, stepping away from simply being a commentator, what's your preferred outcome? I guess at some level you must want to hold the country together and think that there must be some type of policies, even if unrealistic, that could be implemented that might hope to achieve that aim.
Well, so I mean, there's layers to my views here. So the policies that have been pursued in order to stitch the country back together have been mass immigration and economic transfers between regions. I don't think that those policies, even if those policies were successful at knitting the political unit back together. I don't think those policies are worth the, I don't think the juice is worth the squeeze on those policies. Like if you could bring in another 15 million migrants into Canada and homogenize the politics, I think that would, you would destroy the thing in order to try to save it. So generally I find myself on the regionalist side of these debates because the people who are regionalists are also the people who are committed to preserving actual Canadian culture and actual Canadian identity. And I think in some ways, a less centralized state that is weaker might do a better job of that. However, I think that the biggest threat to kind of that less centralized state is I don't think the cultural concerns of Quebec can really be addressed without the ability of Quebec to control its own borders, which I think will ultimately lead them to, down a path towards separatism. And I think that's, it's just, it's an unfortunate set of incentives. And I think the only, like the argument to be made is that the argument that the United States is a profoundly homogenizing force still holds a great deal of water. It still makes sense for these people groups to pursue a common political interest. The problem is the incentives of that central government are very perverse. And so that central government, the experiment has not worked very well in terms of building a central state. For my own part, I don't have a lot of hope that that central government is going to survive and be able to keep the country together. I focus a lot more on what will happen rather than trying to propose some magic bullet to try to resurrect the Canadian central government. I think they would find their feet again if they tried to, like, the way to recover for them would be to let go of transfer payments and to let go of mass migration and try to keep the country together as a kind of looser confederation for a while until time healed some of the cultural wounds that have been inflicted on the country. I think if you were, you know, thinking in terms of what's likely to preserve Canada as a country, if you take mass migration off, if you clean up the academic problems we have in this country, we have a huge issue with the repurposing of the academic system as a kind of visa grift.
I think there's something about that.
Yeah, I mean, we have more people in this country on student visas than we have slots in universities, which is just incredibly abusive. And so I think if you cleaned up a number of these problems and just, you know, took your hands off for a while, a lot of those cultural wounds would heal over time. And you could do things to reinforce a common Canadian identity again, or even like a bicultural identity again. But in some ways you've got, you know, a population of 10 million non-Canadians in a country of 40 million, like 10 million first generation migrants in a country of 40 million. That's a very, very difficult situation to recover from. It's going to take time to reestablish even a base level of cultural cohesion.
Yeah. I mean, look, there's so many parallels between Canada and Australia. And I think what I'm hearing is that the political class in Canada, maybe for self-interested reasons like you claim, forgot that that trade and immigration, amongst other things, need to have restrictions on them in order to establish an independent nation and to maintain and bind a nation together. And they let go of that in the 70s, 80s, both in Canada and Australia, and became, you know, free trade and open borders, immigration type of nation. And now those stresses are
very acute.
Yeah, on both these new world Anglo democracies, senior dominions, or what they used to be called. Yeah.
Well, and I think the other common dynamic is that both of these nations now sit at they now sit in a position where elements of its elite would like to play China versus the United States off against each other.
Yeah,
this strategy might be a little bit more viable in Australia, because Australia is a long way from the United States, and the United States has, you know, less immediate levers and less immediate interests. But I see this going on in Canadian Liberal politics, and I wonder if these people have not watched the Ukraine war. Like, there's no way that the American government is going to tolerate in the long term Canada as a deep relationship between Canada and a geopolitical rival to the United States. Whatever you think about that dynamic ethically, like, there's just no way that's ever going to be tolerated. And so you have elements of the Liberal Party. I mean, this is another piece that I talk about periodically. There was a Canadian Intelligence Services report during the dying days of the Trudeau administration that pointed out that a huge fraction of MPs in Canada were witting recipients of foreign money, presumably from India and or China, and that at least one member of the Liberal Party of Canada who was a sitting MP had an inappropriate association with the CCP. These are the kinds of things that you could be unserious about in, you know, 1994, when Bush Senior was running the New World Order and there were no geopolitical rivals to the United States. But we don't live in that world anymore. It's been a long time since we lived in that world, and it's very difficult to turn back the clock and make Canadian politicians take geopolitics seriously again.
I smile because so much of the political class in Australia still thinks it's 1994, if not 1984, in many, many cases, and haven't adjusted. They don't appreciate that a new policy framework is required for the new times in which we live. And
I'm less committed to precisely the same political situation in Canada prevailing forever, but having a situation where there are geopolitical rivals of the United States that have substantial political influence in Canadian politics is just, you're asking for serious there's no way that that ends well for Canada from a strategic point of view. And so I understand why the United States has serious concerns. I understand why they are attempting to extract concessions with their repeated threats for tariffs, and I think at some point a more serious administration in Washington is going to show up and be a little bit more consistent in their approach to extracting those concessions, and it's going to be very painful for this country.
Yeah. On trade, I think in Australia at least, people don't appreciate that if the United States is changing its trade arrangements with China and elsewhere, Canada necessarily has to adjust, because otherwise China can just ship stuff to Vancouver and then, you know, despite rules of origin or what have, use Canada as a base to send stuff into the United States if Canada still remains part of a broadly free trade zone there. What ideally do you think a future trade agreement will look like and should look like with the United States?
Well, I think the framework that existed with the USMCA was pretty reasonable. I think the actual concessions that the United States wants have very little to do with actually revising trade. There are some longstanding disputes. Canada has a very protectionist set of measures around certain agricultural products, and there's a dispute that's gone on for like 40 years over stumpage fees in the timber industry, and those are things that are going to be negotiated forever. But I don't think the actual disputes here relate to trade per se. I think the United States has legitimate strategic concerns about the way that Canada manages itself. And one of these concerns is like CCP infiltration through the security state. One of these concerns is mass immigration from geopolitical rivals of the United States. One of these concerns is that we spend nothing on our military. I'm sure the United States would love us to be spending, the NATO guidelines of 2% of GDP on our military. I think that's a pretty reasonable demand of a partner like that. So I think if you had a competent partner in Ottawa, I think you could get an agreement along those lines pretty easily, despite all the bluster about people being ripped off. I don't see a lot of barriers to getting something like that done, except that it is not in the political interest of the Liberal Party to do so, because of their relationship with client groups that are migrant groups. I think if we were facing a CPC large majority like we were before the Trump, like we were prior to the replacement of Trudeau with Carney and the Trump tariff threats, I think the U.S. would have been able to address every one of its concerns with an incoming Conservative Party of Canada government, and we would be on a path to a trade agreement both sides would be very happy with. Mm-hmm. And I think most of the changes would be things not that you wouldn't immediately think are related to trade. I think they'd be... Okay. I think you'd see like changes in the military posture of Canada. I think you'd see the Trump administration has concerns over the way that the, particularly the West Coast ports of Canada are policed for both contraband, but also for tariff evasion in their efforts to enforce new trade policy outside of the North American trading bloc. So I think if you addressed some of those concerns, I think you could pretty easily get a trade agreement.
Yeah. We haven't talked about mass immigration, and that's tends to be like a number one issue driving, let's call it, nationalist politics across the Western world. Can you give people a sense in Australia about what has happened over the last 10 years with regard to immigration in Canada?
Yeah, so the immigration story in Canada goes back further than it does most places. Mm-hmm. So I mentioned earlier that in the 70s, there was an intentional effort by the Liberal Party of Canada to reframe Canada from a bicultural nation, French and English, to a cultural mosaic. And in effort to do so, we developed a points-based migration system that was at very, very high levels compared to other places in the world. So beginning in the 80s, large numbers of migrants started to come to this country through this points-based scheme that privileged people coming.
When did Canada get rid of a non-discriminatory immigration policy? Because it's... Is that in the 60s as well, or later?
Yeah, so the revision occurs in the late 70s, I believe. Okay. So prior to, there's really three waves of migration that form Anglo-Canada, French Canada. Almost everyone who is in French Canada is descended from French Canadian settlers from the 17th century. Mm. English Canada is formed The first wave is the Loyalist wave. The second wave is a British imperial wave in the 19th century that forms the core of the Anglo-Canadian population. And there's a pre-World War I wave intended to settle the western part of the country. There's very little migration between the beginning of World War I and really 1970. There's some migration after the war of displaced persons from Europe. Beginning in the late 70s and early 80s, the gates are very, very open to migrants from the former British Empire who, on this points-based system where speaking one of the official languages, French or English, is a huge credit to you, coming from a former British colony is a credit to you, and were during this period selecting the best educated, most qualified people in that group, in those groups. We actually do pretty well economically out of immigration between sort of 1975 and 2005, but the ethnic character of the country changes a lot in that period. So you already have in the 90s large enclaves of people from, you know, people who speak different languages in Canada and have their own schools established in different languages in Canada by that point. So in some senses, the kind of mass migration that people talk about elsewhere in the world starts a bit earlier in Canada with this points-based system. Having said that, this system accelerates quite a bit from 2005 to 2015 when Justin Trudeau is elected, and then is radically accelerated under Justin Trudeau. And it's accelerated under Justin Trudeau in a very interesting way. Prior to Justin Trudeau's election in 2015, almost all migration to Canada comes via this points-based system and is broadly consists of migrants that have a genuine economic opportunity in Canada. After 2015, there are two classes of migrant or three classes of migrant that really explode in terms of scale. The first is the refugee. The second is the student visa holder. And the third is the temporary foreign worker. To give you a sense, Canada had like tens of thousands of temporary foreign workers in 2014. We now have millions of them. I think there's 5 million people in Canada on either temporary foreign worker visas or student visas due to expire in the next 2 years, all of whom have arrived here in the last couple of years, particularly since COVID. So you're talking well over a million a year arriving just on these programs in a country of 30 or 40 million. So like, you know, country of 40 million, 5 million temporary foreign workers and students. What's that? 2.5% of the population that have just been here for a couple of years.
Yeah.
And you've got, add to that, more than 600,000 a year on the points-based system. So on a per capita basis, Canada has been subject to the most intense period of mass migration in its history, and a more intense period of mass migration than any peer nation during the period.
It's interesting because this is mirrored across the Western world, right? Australia has also had record numbers of students, and in the UK, the classic line is that there's been more people that have migrated to the UK in the last 20 years than there have been in the last 1,000 years. So it's just it's at some level, whether you think it's coordinated or there's something, just the drivers are the same on the political class, encouraging to implement the same types of policies. They're all pushing in the same direction, and nothing seems to be able to turn them around.
Yeah, well, the thing that is interesting So there's a couple of layers to this that are kind of interesting in Canada. Mm-hmm. First, and I suspect this is probably common to a lot of places, the set of migration that has come, particularly since COVID, has so prior to this wave, there's a consistent pattern of argumentation among the elite class. This was good for the economy and essential, especially as birth rates in Canada have declined. But every analysis of migration in the Trudeau era has shown that migrants, that the migration program is a substantial net drain on the economy because of the social support that these people require. Mm. And because of their lifetime social support versus their lifetime contribution to the tax base. So that's been a big change. The program, the previous iteration of the points-based program, you know, in the 80s and 90s, was actually pretty successful, putting aside cultural concerns, at bringing people to the country that enriched it. Whereas the program in the Justin Trudeau era has been a program that has almost inarguably impoverished the country. The other thing that has changed is that because these people have come in such large numbers from such, I call it sole source migration. So these people have come overwhelmingly from one or two sources in the world, particularly Khalistani Sikhs from India. They have organized politically within Canada and formed a competing power block. And the fact that that competing power bloc for the first time sided against the Liberal Party with the Conservative Party in the Justin Trudeau era has caused a lot of consternation in the Liberal Party over mass migration. So we went from Justin Trudeau saying that Canada is the first post-national state, has no particular identity, has no particular historic culture that it's committed to Mark Carney referencing Canada as a nation of three peoples, French, English, and Native American, and talking about the importance of its British colonial history. You have Justin Trudeau. I have a montage on my YouTube channel that I call Justin Trudeau Immigration Restrictionist. That is all of his sort of last 6 months of his political career, where he promises to take immigration. Well, he promises to not renew the 5 million visas associated with temporary foreign workers and students, which would put Canada in this position where you'd have 5 million people who theoretically have to leave the country. Every party going into the election is promising to reduce migration because it's, you know, because it has become this kind of political football. And yet most people who you talk to don't actually believe that any of the parties who are elected will actually reduce immigration.
Oh, it sounds so similar to our election campaign here in Australia, I must admit. And there's some parallels where each of the political parties at one time or another try to claim either the Indian or the Chinese bloc as their own.
Depending
on how the winds are going. And it's interesting how dexterous these people, you know, left-wing politicians are. You know, Keir Starmer in the UK sounds, you know, saying things on immigration now, which would have been him branding that person a far-right extremist only, you know, less than a year ago. I've kept you for an hour, and I try to keep things to that. Just as a final question, it's been a bit kind of gloomy, but if you could paint a wildly optimistic picture of how things could be turned around in Canada over the next, you know, 10 or 20 years, because Canada has such, I mean, you know, it has some of the best, I've been a fan of, you know, people like Mark Stein and Conrad Black and John Buchan, and you get glimpses of that kind of, I don't know, feisty, patriotic Canada in things like the truckers' protests, which, you know, came out of nowhere, and at least from a distance, you know, was kind of inspiring. Yeah, how can there be a better story there in Canada?
Yeah, so Canada is a tremendously naturally gifted country that has enormous unoccupied space that its migrant populations could very well settle in. It has some of the most effective and most organized anti-progressive political movements that exist anywhere outside of Europe. Canada has what else is there to say? Canada has groups that are culturally chauvinistic about their historical cultures in ways that most other nations do not, both in French Canada and in pockets of English Canada. Groups that are entirely prepared to bridge their culture through a very difficult period and bring it forward in a positive way into the future in whatever political arrangement exists on the other side of this disruption. I think it's very likely that the Canadian peoples will produce for themselves a future which, not only that, Canada has some of the most impressive individual people that you find anywhere in the world. You find them producing art and intellectual work and business work that is just unparalleled anywhere in the world. So you have a very difficult political moment. You have a situation where the governance of the country is very difficult. But on the other side of what I suspect will be a very, very difficult decade, two decades in Canada, you have people and groups of people entirely prepared to bring forward an iteration of their culture on the other side of this disruption, which will be excellent. And I see no reason to believe that what I expect to be some economic and cultural challenges related to combination of mass migration, the reorganization of trade, I see no reason to think that either of those two things is going to end that long, continuous culture. I mean, Canada has experienced mass migration in the past. Canada's experienced economic privation in the past, and we've continued to exist as a people. I just think, you know, people need to understand that there's going to be a difficult political period, and that we're not yet in a situation where the incentives align to immediately pull out of this and find a nice, elegant solution. You're going to, there's going to have to be a period where Canadians collectively remember that they have an identity and culture which is worth fighting for and worth tremendous sacrifice for, and that we have a long tradition of doing so. I mean, my ancestors came to this country after the Revolutionary War in the United States. At the time, it was a frozen wilderness, and they built a little England for themselves here. And we'll do it again.
Yeah. That's the spirit. Hey, mate, I was really looking forward to this conversation, and it's lived up to my expectations, and I'm sure others will get a great deal from listening in. I'll drop all the relevant stuff regarding how to contact you and keep up to date on your writings in the show notes. But go well, and good luck with the election, whatever the result, and look forward to keeping in touch in future.
Thank you so much.
Cheers, man. Bye.